This is James R. Copeland, the director of the Center for Legal Policy at the Manhattan Institute. It's my pleasure to have with us here today my friend Philip K. Howard of Common Good and Covington and Burling. His most recent book, his fourth book, The Rule of Nobody, is a nominee for the Manhattan Institute's Hayek Book Prize this year in 2015. So we're going to spend some time together talking about the concepts in that book. I want to emphasize that Philip has been a major intellectual leader in looking to reform our nation's civil liability system, and more broadly, our government in the United States, dating back to his 1994 bestseller, The Death of Common Sense. This is the third book I've had the pleasure of hosting an event for at the Manhattan Institute since I've been here, which I guess tells you a little bit about how long I've been doing this too. And I think it's a fantastic book. So let's get into the book, Philip. Welcome. Congratulations on your nomination. And tell us a little bit about what you mean by the rule of nobody.
Well, very nice to be with you, Jim. Well, I think we've created a system of government that's explicitly designed to avoid human choice at the point of interaction. We have this idea that law can save us from ourselves. And so in the old days, laws used to be general principles and goals by and large. And so the Constitution's 10 pages long. The Volcker rule to implement one small part of the Dodd-Frank law is 950 pages long. It's completely incomprehensible. I was with Paul Volcker the other day. He said he can't read it, much less understand it. You know, it's the rule named after him. So you have this system of, quote, law that is by and large incoherent to most people and operates as a form of central planning. So it's very hard to get anything done.
That seems like a big contrast from the sort of spontaneous rule of order that Hayek talked about and sort of the common law tradition in the United States, although obviously some of our common law tradition today doesn't work so well. How did we get here?
It's interesting. You know, Friedrich Hayek was so influential to me and my thinking, and I was going back through the dozens of occasions when I've quoted him in my books, including in this book, and he understood, he saw it coming, you know, as early as the Road to Serfdom back in the 40s, and really in the Constitution of Liberty, about this notion that somehow law could be bigger and better than people, and that a human accomplishment could be ordered to be correct by just telling people what to do. I mean, Friedrich Hayek, from his first breath, basically proved why that could never work, that human spontaneity and human idiosyncrasy and the what he called the unconscious forces of which we are not aware, you know, are the ways in which we accomplish things, trial and error. You know, the sort of going back and forth, bobbing and weaving. One of the points I make some places, you know, in the history of mankind, nothing good has ever been accomplished because someone followed a rule. Rules are important to prevent bad things from happening and maybe to set goals. But getting anything done requires human initiative and willpower and that, you know, mysterious workings that's different in every person, but enables people to get things done in very different ways.
So tell us a little bit. I mean, you talked about the Volcker as an example. Your book is the case with all your books, filled with examples of how this law can become stifling. Give us some examples of how the law stifles. First, let's start with how it stifles government decision making, and then let's talk about how it stifles individual and business decision making.
Well, it's incredibly stupid how it works. I mean, I tell a story: a tree falls in a creek, causes flooding, and the mayor's not allowed to pull it out with a backhoe because it's a Class C1 creek, whatever that means. So it takes 2 weeks and thousands of dollars of legal fees for the mayor to get approval to pull a tree out of a creek that's causing flooding. It's completely stupid. President Obama, with bipartisan support, gets $800 billion to stimulate the economy. The first stated goal is infrastructure. 5 years later, they have a White House, a five-year report. Buried in the back of the report is this figure. 3.6% of the money gets spent on transportation infrastructure. You say, well, how could that be? Well, it turns out that the president of the United States, duly elected by majority, lacks the authority to approve the most mundane rebuilding projects. We're not talking about the Keystone Pipeline or the, you know, roads through virgin forest, just rebuilding what's there. By contrast, Harry Hopkins within 7 weeks after passage of the Civil Works Administration and the New Deal, had hired 2 million unemployed Americans. So something happened in the way we organized government that made it almost impossible for government to do anything, the most mundane things.
That's really remarkable. It hasn't been that long since the New Deal. I mean, there are plenty of people
right.
still around that remember the New Deal. How did the government get so enmeshed in law that it can't even do the basic job?
You know, we have this, it's really a defective philosophy, a defective idea of the rule of law. We got this notion that if you could create, coming out of the 60s, that we could avoid bad values by creating a legal system where nobody ever had to apply their values. So, for example, there is no one in the federal government who has the job of saying when there's been enough review, environmental review. That's madness. So instead, you have this moebius strip of a dozen or more agencies, each asking for more things until at the end, finally people drop of exhaustion and there's a 10 or 20,000 page environmental impact statement when in many cases it probably could have been done with 50 or 100 pages.
Which still sounds like a lot to most of us who know how much it takes to put together a 50 or 100 page report. So how does this impact individual initiative? And it's one thing to say we're stifling government
right.
and the ability of government to do public things. And clearly there are things that require public finance
right.
and collective action. But I think more troubling for those of us perhaps at the Manhattan
right.
Institute or followers of Hayek would be how this stifles individual and business action.
Yeah. And so there's this kind of law of legal theory. Physics, which is if the judge or the official doesn't have the flexibility to use his or her common sense, pretty soon neither will the people in a free society. So I give two examples of that. The U.S. now ranks 46th in the world in ease of starting a business, in the latest World Bank rankings. Mayor Bloomberg found that it took approvals from 11 different agencies to open a restaurant in New York City. So what that means is to get a permit, you're not going to the government. You're going to 11 different governments. It's this hydra-headed monster. And they'll disagree with each other a lot of the times. And so getting a permit involves a dynamic that's not unlike negotiating an international treaty. It's other countries, by contrast, have developed a one-stop shop where they appoint a lead agency which actually has authority to give final permission on behalf of one government. We don't have one government anymore. Literally scores of governments, and in any big project, you know, we'll have federal, state, local, power line going from Wyoming wind farms up to the Pacific Northwest has to get the approval of every county in Idaho through which it passes. Well, that's madness. It literally is madness. So the paralysis within government basically ripples out into the paralysis of society. The fact that judges don't see it as their job to dismiss unreasonable claims means that everyone in America has lost the freedom to act reasonably when dealing with others. So it is the rule in America that no businesses give job references. It is the rule in America that teachers will never put an arm around a crying child, just as an example.
Because there's just too much legal risk.
Much legal risk, and no one will defend you if somebody makes a claim, however unreasonable or bogus.
Wow. Well, the subtitle of your book is Saving America from Dead Laws and Broken Governments. So part of implicit in that is that there may be a way out of this.
Yeah.
How do we do that? How do we get rid of the dead laws? How do we fix the broken government?
Well, first of all, we have to have the idea that law needs to get changed. You know, we treat law like it's the Ten Commandments, all of it, even though it's like the 10 million commandments at this point. So members of Congress don't even have the idea that they're responsible for old law. It's incredible. Who do they think's responsible for it? You know, so America is really run by dead people. It's whoever wrote all these laws and regulations. They accrete decade after decade. And at this point, like sediment in the harbor, you know, nobody can get anywhere. So the first important job to fix this is to have commissions to go back and clean out obsolete law, duplicative law, unintended consequences of perfectly good laws, to rationalize it. We don't need 82 teacher training programs in the federal government. Maybe one would do. You know, so the quote, rule of law, regulatory law, is not a code. It's a junk pile. It's a well-intentioned junk pile. So one thing we need to do is we need a recodification, like the Uniform Commercial Code in the 1950s or, you know, the Napoleonic Code or the Justinian Code. And there's no way around it because all this stuff is law, right? So George Washington could be reincarnated and be elected, and he couldn't run this government because the law wouldn't let him. So we have to, we don't have a choice. We got to go clean it out.
Interesting. Well, who are some of the vested interests that protect this? I mean, obviously the lawyers and I guess some of the accountants and et cetera. But if we were going to try to go through a clean up the code type project like you envisioned, who's going to fight that? Who's going to oppose that? It sounds like a great idea.
Well, in a sense, everyone will oppose it because everyone has a vested interest in some piece of this law. That's sort of why it exists. The framers actually made a mistake. They didn't understand that amending a law or getting rid of a law would be much harder than passing one. So they put all these checks and balances in to prevent new laws from burdening the society without understanding that those same checks and balances after 200 years would make it almost impossible to get rid of obsolete law. So because an army of special interests around each one. So we have farm subsidies from the New Deal. The farmers, mainly corporate farmers, have a vested interest in preserving them. We desperately need to turn public service into a merit system, not an entitlement system. The same with teachers' union. Well, they have a one party, I forget which one, is completely in the pocket of the public unions. We need to make justice reasonable so that people can be free. Well, there's a group of influential trial lawyers who get in the way of that. The tax code is a jungle. And there's not one company that doesn't have some piece of the tax code that they want to protect. They'll all be better off if it gets simplified, but that requires them all to lose something. You know, the way this is always done is done by, it's never done by legislature. It's hopeless. I mean, it's hopeless for 400, 500 people to come up with this. Recodifications always occur by giving a small committee the job of proposing a new code. And then you have it, it's like a base closing commission or something. And then you have the proposal there and you can vote it up or down. But you can see what the advantages and disadvantages are you of the whole code. And that sort of stops this kind of, you know, nibbling by all the interests to try to change this or that. If you do that and a company or the farmers can see, well, they're going to be better off even though there are these changes and they don't get these subsidies because maybe the tax rate isn't as high or, you know, or some other change that's occurred. But that's the way it has to work.
Thinking about this a little critically, don't we have some of these operating already? I mean, in the last couple of years, I've addressed the Administrative Conference of the United States, the U.S. Sentencing Commission. I mean, these sorts of groups, I mean, isn't that what their job is supposed to be, to rethink this? And of course, in the broader legal stand, we have the American Law Institute, which is not a government body, but certainly trying to think about how the law ought to move or change. What prevents these sorts of groups and committees from being effective if they're not?
Well, I'm involved with some of those groups, and I think they do important work, but they mainly see their job as going into the Amazon jungle with a pair of shears and cleaning it up on the edges. And what I suggest in the Rule of Nobody is that we've created a structure in which both people don't have the freedom to do their jobs and make things happen, and also no one has responsibility. You know, who's responsible for the budget deficit, right? Nobody. So in order to restore the bones of a working democracy, you know, where people actually have just powers derived from the consent of the governed and also are accountable, you have to really rebuild the whole thing. And that's not what those organizations are in the business of doing.
So we just need something more systemic, broader authority. And that's obviously a big lift.
History will show it only happens in times of crisis.
Yeah. So, Philip, it's been a fascinating discussion. It's a wonderful book. Friedrich Hayek, while trained as an economist, was very much focused on law, as you're aware. The Constitution of Liberty, the law, legislation, and liberty, very much focused on the rule of law, the common law, and how these legal rules work and were essential to liberty. And I think regardless of what the solutions are, and people may differ on the margins here, I think I certainly, and I think most of our audience here will probably agree with a lot of the broad critiques you make, and would be well served from reading this book. So best of luck. Congratulations on the nomination for the Hayek Book Prize. And thanks for all the collaboration over the years with the Manhattan Institute and our Center for Legal Policy.
Great to be with you again, Jim.